Thank you for joining me tonight in a time of prayer. Again, as our National Day of Prayer is coming to an end on this side of the country, there's still several hours yet to fall across our nation. And I'm sure that there are many other churches like ours, small and insignificant in our own eyes, but in the hands of God, we can be used mightily. And so I believe he is doing that, and he will do that in the days ahead. So thank you for being willing to share in this time of prayer together. We are going to at least begin tonight in our study of the next book in the Old Testament following Nehemiah, which is the book of Esther. And the reason I'm going to be focusing on Esther is because, again, Ezra, which preceded Nehemiah, and the book of Nehemiah, and the book of Esther comprise a time period that is what we call the post-exilic period, meaning that it's after the captivity from Babylon that the people of God were brought back into the land. And each of these three books share a particular aspect of that period that is unique in all of the Word of God. And so in the book of Esther, we find information that is not included in the other books, and vice versa. With regard to Ezra, he covered a specific period of time. Actually, he covered a couple of different periods of time. And Nehemiah covered also a section of time that followed after both Ezra and Esther. I want to take a few moments just to go through the history, if you will, of that period. Remember that the Babylonian captivity lasted until 536 BC, when the Gentile king Cyrus, king of Persia, which country had defeated Babylon, in 536 gave a decree to allow the people of God to return to Judah, to Jerusalem, and rebuild the city. He allowed that and funded it, and it was a gracious thing that was done by him. And you may remember, even 150 years before the man Cyrus was born, Isaiah the prophet spoke by his name being declared as God's vessel that would be used by the Lord in a time of restoration from their captivity. And Cyrus, the Gentile king of Persia, completed that task, fulfilled that role. 536, Zerubbabel and Joshua led about 50,000 Israelites back from Babylonian captivity. That's only a very small portion of the total number of people that were Jews and that were still living in captivity, but only those 50,000 returned. Most of the other people that were Jewish lovers of God, but had settled into their captivity. They had become merchants. They had become familiar with the customs of the land of the Babylonians and other places where they were held captive. They had established families and relationships and businesses, and they didn't want to go back to Jerusalem because Jerusalem was a war-torn city. It was in complete desolation. They didn't want to have to start over, many of them, so they stayed in their land of captivity, but they prospered there. But from 536 until 516 B.C., Zerubbabel and Joshua made an attempt to rebuild the temple, and it was finally built. It took a long time. There were many delays. There was much opposition, but they were able to accomplish that task. And Ezra is the one that records all of the details of that. In chapters 1 through 6 of the book of Ezra, we find those historical records that Ezra gave us with regard to Zerubbabel and Joshua's efforts. And then in chapter 7, Ezra moves forward in time to his own day, which was around 450 or 460 BC, where he was able to go back into the city of Jerusalem, and he felt a strong desire in his heart to restore the word of God for the people there. And he was a scribe, he was a priest, and he was familiar with the law of Moses. And he brought the word of God back to the land. So chapters 7 and following in the book of Ezra talked about his experience as he had come back to the land in that later period of time. Nehemiah was a cupbearer under the reign of Artaxerxes. Artaxerxes reigned from around 463 until about 425 BC. And as a cupbearer in Persia, Nehemiah was favored by Artaxerxes, and he allowed Nehemiah to go back to Jerusalem with a decree that said it was time for them to rebuild the walls of Jerusalem. Until then, the walls had been still torn down since the Babylonian captivity, and it was a very dangerous place for the people of Israel to live. Nehemiah went there, and he, in his book, demonstrated how the people of God got together and were able to rebuild the walls. And that was a very, very important declaration that Artaxerxes made, and the decree was especially important because it was in fulfillment of Daniel's prophecy that when that decree was to be made, it was to be the beginning of a period of time of a total of 490 years, the time in which God was once again going to deal with his people. Up until the time of Jesus, 483 years of that 490 years had been fulfilled. There's still another 7 years left in that prophetic word from Daniel that have yet to be fulfilled. That will be the time of Jacob's trouble. That would be what we know of as the 7 years of tribulation that is yet to come. So these books are very, very important to us. But now the book of Esther. Esther is a very interesting book for many reasons. First of all, Esther is still one of those, along with her uncle Mordecai, who are still in the land of captivity. Esther, historically, chronologically, falls in the middle between the first six chapters of the book of Ezra and the last chapters of the book of Ezra, and including the time of Nehemiah. In other words, Ezra came around the time of the...
What did you take that?
I'm going to mute everybody here for so I can not have that kind of background. But Ezra, again, began his ministry around 450, 455 B.C. Esther was in the period of the king prior to that king, Artaxerxes. The king that is mentioned in the book of Esther is actually Artaxerxes' father. His name was Ahasuerus, and he's also known as Xerxes. Now, Xerxes, or Ahasuerus, was the son of Darius I, who was the son of Cyrus. So he's Cyrus's grandson, and he's begun his reign in 485 B.C., and will reign until about 464 B.C. And that's the period of time that we find the story of Esther is taking place, shortly after the beginning of his reign. In the book of Esther, you will not find one single reference to God, either by the name Yahweh or Jehovah or Adonai, or the Lord. There's no mention of God at all in this book. It stands uniquely in that place, with the exception perhaps of the Song of Solomon, it is the only book that does not make mention of the Lord. But in this book, it is so very, very profound in that it shows us God's providence. His hand is all through this book. God is directing the events that will be recorded, have been recorded in this book, for us to see that behind the scenes, God is working out His perfect will in the lives of His people. It was a very, very important book because it shows how God protects His people. And it's one of the many places in the Old Testament where it's very obvious that Satan is doing his very best to destroy the people of God, to wipe them out. Right from the very beginning, that's been Satan's design. His only great hope is that he will someday, somehow, be able to thwart the plan of God. And the only way that he can do that is by eliminating his people. That's why today especially the people of God, the nation of Israel, are such an important part of what God is doing in our present day. If the nation of Israel were not in existence today, we would be very, very much without hope. But we have a very strong hope in the fact that God is doing a mighty work in these last days, and the Israel nation is proof of it. And so are you and I. But in Ezra's day, in Nehemiah's day, God was doing a work. And now in Esther's experience, as recorded in the book of Esther here that we have before us, we're seeing another work that is being done. It's outside of Israel. It's outside of Jerusalem. It's outside of Judah. It's in a land of captivity. It's in a culture of the Persian Empire. And we'll see a great deal of information that is given by the writer of this book. And by the way, we don't really know who it is that wrote the book. Many believe it was Mordecai, which is going to be, as we'll find in chapter 2 and 3, the uncle of the primary character, Esther. But we're not going to see Esther or Mordecai until the second chapter. We'll probably not get there tonight. But I want us to understand the setting, the timing, and the conditions of the people of God. They're still in captivity. They're far from God in many ways. But yet they have a sense of God directing their lives. And perhaps the very key verse in the entire book is found in Esther chapter 4. And I'm not going to give you the details about that, but Mordecai is going to be involved in helping Esther become a very large player in the plan of God. And he suggests to Esther that she's there for such a time as this. And that's what we'll see when eventually we get to chapter 4 and we'll read that portion together. But I'd like now just to begin a few verses to set the stage in our study in the book of Esther, right before we end our time together tonight. So turn with me to the book of Esther. It follows in Nehemiah right immediately after the book of Nehemiah. And it tells us that in the days of Ahasuerus, and it says, this was the Ahasuerus who reigned over 127 provinces from India to Ethiopia. In those days, King Ahasuerus sat on the throne of the kingdom, which was in Shushan, the citadel, that in the third year of his reign he made a feast for all his officials and servants, the powers of Persia and Media, the nobles and the princes of the provinces being before him. When he showed the riches of his glorious kingdom and the splendor of his excellent majesty for many days, 180 days in all. And when these days were completed, the king made a feast lasting 7 days for all the people who were present in Shushan, the citadel, from great to small, in the court of the garden of the king's palace. So here's the setting. Ahasuerus again began his reign in 4 483 BC, or 485 BC rather. And in his third year, it tells us, it came to pass that he held this amazing feast that lasted a half a year, 180 days, about 6 months. As he sat on his throne in his kingdom, it was in the citadel in the place named Shushan. Now, Shushan is in what is now present-day Iraq, in the southern part of the country. It was a winter place for the king to enter into that area of the nation. It was much cooler in the wintertime and not as cold as the original Persian capital where the king would normally sit in the summer. But in the wintertime, they came down to Shushan and stayed in that citadel that was present in there. It was a very luxurious place, very well ordained. And we'll see some of the great wealth that was present in that place as we read further. But again, it focuses on, in this particular period of time, just a short few years after his reign had begun, that he entered into Shushan and conducted this feast. Now, we're not told here what this feast was for, but history does tell us some suggestions. When he began his reign, there were some rebellion against him after he took over from Darius I, who wanted to not allow him to reign over them, primarily from the Grecian colonies, and also from Egypt and from other places, a few other places as well. He was able to put them down and conquer them. Egypt and Greece at the time were trying to take him off of the throne, but they were unsuccessful. So this particular feast may be a celebratory feast in the fact that they had won victories against Egypt and against Greece. But Greece will continue to become a thorn in Ahasuerus' flesh. And it may also be that this gathering was to encourage all the various provinces to stand with him against the Grecian Empire that was beginning to threaten him. That did take place in the years following. But during this time, at least he has a short period of peace, and he's celebrating, I believe, his victories against Egypt and the temporary victories against the Grecian colonies as well. It is at this time that the story begins. Greece will ultimately conquer Persia at the hand of Alexander the Great. But it won't be for another 140 or more years after this period of time. But here we have what's going on now in Shushan, in the citadel, in the king's palace, in the court of the garden, where after the 180 days have finished, he invites all of the people to come, commoners as well as dignitaries, to enjoy a 7-day period of feasting as well. So it's a great celebration that's going on. It says in verse 6, there were white and blue linen curtains fastened with cords of fine linen and purple on silver rods and marble pillars, and the couches were of gold and of silver on a mosaic pavement of alabaster, turquoise, and white and black marble. Look at the luxury. Look at the opulence. Look at the grandeur of this place. Great wealth was being expressed here. And then it says the conditions under which the feast was being held. In verse 7 it says, they served drinks in golden vessels, each vessel being different from the other, with royal wine in abundance, according to the generosity of the king. So they're pouring out all the alcohol that they can get their hands on, and the people for all of this period of time are primarily just simply getting drunk day after day after day after day. That was the way the world was back then. I guess we could say it's Not any different today, is it? Washington, D.C., per capita, has more alcohol consumption than anywhere else in the United States of America. Think about that. Our capital is just like the capital in Shushan was. It says in verse 8, in accordance with the law, the drinking was not compulsory. They didn't make them drink. Of course, they didn't stop them from drinking either. But it says it wasn't compulsory, for so the king had ordered in all the officers of his household that they should do according to each man's pleasure. No compulsion, no requirements, just have a good old time, enjoy yourself on the king. He's going to pay the tab, just go for it. However, take note of the fact that this was a place where only men were gathered. The princes of the various provinces had come. The queen and all the women of those princes were not invited to that 180-day feast. Until, in verse 9, we find Ahasuerus makes a decision. He says this. He says, Queen Vashti also made a feast for the women in the royal palace which belonged to King Ahasuerus. They were in a separate place, having a kind of their own party themselves. And on the seventh day, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, that's just a polite way of saying he was inebriated, he commanded Mehunim, Bistha, Harbona, Bigtha, Abagtha, Zethar, and Carcass, seven eunuchs who served in the presence of King Ahasuerus, to bring King Vashti before the king, wearing her royal crown, in order to show her beauty to the people and the officials, for she was beautiful to behold. So King Ahasuerus, in his drunken stupor, decides, I want my queen to be here, and I want to show her off to all of these men who are here with me. All of these men who are inebriated just like I am, I want them to see the beauty of my queen. Queen Vashti was indeed, apparently, a very beautiful woman. But note that he wants her to come before all of these men and to display herself, some believe, with only the crown on her head and nothing else on. That may be a wrong assumption. I'm not really sure whether it's true or not. But just for the fact that he's asking just the queen to come and to stand among all of those men would have been a terrible embarrassment for her. Even in that culture, in that day, women wore veils over their faces. They didn't display their facial beauty or any other beauty of their body in any way, shape, or form. It was just not done. But he's asked for her to come with a crown on, and it says in verse 11, again, to bring her before the king, wearing her royal crown in order to show her beauty to the people and the officials, for she was beautiful to behold. But, in verse 12, Queen Vashti refused to come at the king's command brought by his eunuchs. Therefore the king was furious, and his anger burned within him. She didn't want to come. She said no. That was a very daring thing for the queen to have done. In that day, the queen was summoned, and the queen would go. If the queen wasn't summoned, the queen could not enter into the king's presence. It was totally unlike anything ever done before. This was a breach of Persian policy. This was a terrible mistake that she made. But she was right in doing it, because it was a moral issue to her. Or at least it was an issue that she felt was going to bring her some kind of shame that she was not willing to bear. Kudos to her for having taken that stand. But it resulted in a very, very difficult thing for her to endure. Verse 13 says, "Then the king said to the wise men who understood the times, for this was the king's manner toward all who knew the law and justice, that he would go to his wise men to ask them for consultation in this matter. What do you think I'm going to do here?" He says in verse 14, "To those closest to him, being Karshina, Shethar, Admatha, Tarshish, Meres, Marcena, and Memucan, the seven princes of Persia and Media, who had access to the king's presence and who ranked highest in the kingdom, what shall we do to Queen Vashti according to law, because she did not obey the command of King Ahasuerus to bring her by the eunuchs?" So he doesn't even know the full extent of the laws of Persia, but he knew that these men did. He wanted to ask them, what should be done here? I know that this is not right. Something has to be done. What do you recommend based on the laws of the land? And one of those seven men who knew the law, his name was Memucan. It says, "Memucan answered before the king and the princes, 'Queen Vashti has not only wronged the king, but also all the princes and all the people who are in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus. For the queen's behavior will become known to all women, so that they will despise their husbands in their eyes when they report King Ahasuerus commanded Queen Vashti to be brought in before him, but she did not come.'" Here's his answer. "This very day, the noble ladies of Persia and Media will say to all the king's officials that they have heard of the behavior of the queen. Thus there will be excessive contempt and wrath. If it pleases the king, let a royal decree go out from him, and let it be recorded in the laws of the Persians and the Medes, so that it will not be altered, that Vashti shall come no more before King Ahasuerus, and let the king give her royal position to another who is better than she." So he's telling the king, the law says that she has done a terrible dishonor to the king, and the only real solution is for a new law to be made, which cannot be revoked, even by the king himself, that this queen will be dethroned and her crown will be given to another. The reason? Because it would be not only terrible for King Ahasuerus, an embarrassment to him, but it would be also an embarrassment to all of them as well, who are the leaders of their house. Because if they find out that Queen Vashti said no to the command of her husband, then all of the other wives would feel they've got the right to do so also, and they would be in complete disobedience to their husbands, who wanted to be able to lord over them. Frankly, it was a culture where the husband ruled the house, and the wife was obedient to everything the husband would say. They would have to do what the husband asked of them. And here is an example of a woman who would not accept that rule of authority in her own household. And that carried great weight in the households of the entire provinces, all 127 of them. Friends, the Church of Jesus Christ does not allow for husbands to do that to their wives. Instead, the husband is to love their wife, not lord over them, but to cherish them, to love them as Christ loved the church. And yes, Paul does tell us in the book of Ephesians that women are to submit themselves to their husbands. But if you take that in its context, it is not right to assume that she is to do everything you tell her to do. That is absolutely wrong, and I stand against it 100%. In fact, in that same passage in Ephesians, Paul tells husbands and wives both to submit to one another. And yes, he does say that it's the responsibility of the woman to respond to his love by submitting herself, being willing to submit to him, because he has the final say, but she has input. She has good insight that the husband needs to receive and digest and make decisions based upon all of that which he has before him, both her input and his own thoughts on any matter. Never, ever should the husband say to the wife, "I'm the boss. Do as I say." That is not Christ-centered. And that's something that we should always emphasize in our family relationships. God's relationship with his church is one of obedience by the church to his lordship over us, but because we know he loves us and would not want anything to be done to us that would be harmful to us. He's our protector. He is our champion. He's our cover. And we are his faithful bride. That's the relationship we have in the church. That's the relationship they did not have in Persia. And for many, many years, in many other cultures, and even in the Jewish culture, in the Roman culture, in the Greek culture, it was very much the same way. The church has succeeded in introducing a new kind of relationship to the world. Husbands and wives are blessed when they follow after that which God has prescribed in his word. We'll finish the chapter tonight, and then we'll continue next time together, but it's just that I want to end with. In verse 20, it says, "When the king's decree which he will make is proclaimed," this is still the man who is giving this advice, "which he will make is proclaimed throughout all his empire, for it is great, all wives will honor their husbands, both great and small." No, they won't. They'll have to be obedient, but they won't honor them from their heart. Verse 21 says, "And the reply pleased the king and the princes, and the king did according to the word of Memucan. Then he sent letters to all the king's provinces, to each province in its own script, and to every people in their own language, that each man should be master in his own house and speak in the language of his own people." So the decree is made. They've sent it out to all of the people. And now there is going to be a period of time when the king is going to be without a queen. Now, it's actually an extended period of time. 4 years will pass between the time of this event and the time that he begins his time with his new queen, who will become a very good example for them and also for the people of Israel. We'll get into that the next time we meet together, the Lord willing. Until then, my friends, God bless you all. Grace and peace.